Good evening. I'm Marissa Levine, the Director of Inforum and Innovation Lab at the Commonwealth Club. And it is my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's program, Turning Homelessness into Headline News. Now, tonight, Inforum is proud to be a part of the 70-plus media and community organizations producing content and events around the pressing issue of homelessness in the Bay Area this week as part of SF Homeless Project. The broad initiative kicked off officially today, so we feel especially lucky to have editors from four major outlets with us tonight to discuss the project, its impetus, their goals, and what they've learned so far even today. We're also pleased to be displaying art from Artlifting tonight. Artlifting sells art created by homeless individuals who receive half of the profits from their work. We're also collecting personal hygiene products on behalf of Simply the Basics, which provides these products to more than a dozen Bay Area organizations serving the homeless population. Now, one of my favorite things to do. One of the interesting things about the SF Homeless Project was the act of bringing together often divergent or competing outlets together. So in that spirit, let's make a friend tonight. Turn to the person next to you and introduce yourself. Perfect. This is always the hard part, though. I ask you to make friends, and then the conversations just keep going. We will keep pouring wine potentially afterwards, so take your new friend down the hall to look at the art from Artlifting and have another glass. Now, I'm glad everybody's made a new friend. Now, if you're new to Inforum or the Commonwealth Club tonight, tonight's program is just one of hundreds, more than 400 actually, that we produce every year. We're a nonprofit, so we can only do this because of our active community of members, donors, volunteers, and other supporters. Members of my board and the Commonwealth Club staff are here tonight, so ask one of us how you can get more involved. We would love to have you. Quickly, coming up at Inforum in June, and in July now, we're just zipping through the summer here. July 12th, the club hosts Is the Rising Tide Lifting All Boats, a conversation on race and inclusion in the Bay Area. July 14th, the Computer Science of Human Decisions with Brian Christian and Tom Griffiths. July 21st, Inforum hosts Maura Weigel on her new book, Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating. August 16th, we'll actually be announcing a new panel tomorrow called Above the Law, Addressing Sexual Assault on Campus and Beyond, featuring panelists from the law, government, and more. And August 31st, we just announced a program called Redefining Design with Tristan Walker and John Maeda. Tickets to those and more are at commonwealthclub.org. Now, tonight, on this especially media-heavy day, we will be live-tweeting, as always. So find us at InforumSF, and the slide that you see on either side of me actually has our handle, the hashtag SFHomelessProject, so please include that, as well as the handles of our panelists and the outlets that they represent. So we're really energized by the engagement and attention of this project, so get involved and add to it during the program tonight. And now, without further ado, it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's panel. Audrey Cooper, Editor-in-Chief, San Francisco Chronicle. Clara Jeffrey, Editor-in-Chief, Mother Jones. Gary Camilla, Executive Editor, San Francisco Magazine. Holly Kernan, Executive Editor of News, KQED. And our moderator, Edward Wasserman, PhD, Dean of the UC Berkeley Journalism School. Please welcome them to the Inforum stage.
Mine seems live.
Well, good evening and welcome. This panel discussion titled Turning Homelessness into Headline News. My name is Ed Wasserman. I am the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. The Commonwealth Club gathering tonight marks an extraordinary and I'm quite sure unprecedented collaboration in the San Francisco Bay Area to bring an intense focus on homelessness in the region. Its faces, its voices, its causes, and most importantly, what should be done about it. Now, some 70 news organizations are taking part. Now, this is a great comfort to those of us who were surprised to learn there are 70 news organizations. Today, June 29th, is the date that participating media agreed to go public with their findings, their reporting, and their recommendations. Although the news organization that has led this effort, the San Francisco Chronicle, has devoted the entire week to publishing its staff's work. Now, to tell you more about how this project came about and why the journalists who are taking part are hopeful it will make a difference, we've assembled a panel of some of the Bay Area's most distinguished news people. And it's a great pleasure to congratulate them on an exceptional collaboration, exceptional body of work, and to welcome them here tonight. There's Clara Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of Mother Jones, the progressive investigative reporting magazine; Holly Kernan, executive editor of news at KQED, the Bay Area's most influential public radio station; Gary Camilla, co-founder of Salon.com, a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, and executive editor of San Francisco, the city's monthly magazine; and the person who has led this effort, Audrey Cooper, editor-in-chief of the San Francisco Chronicle, the city's 151-year-old daily paper. Welcome to all of you, and let me ask you to welcome them as well. Thank you. Now, the format here is we'll talk for about 45 minutes. I'll pose some questions, which the panelists are welcome to ignore or override or contradict. We're looking for a lively discussion rather than an orderly one. And if people have questions to answer, rather if people have answers to questions I haven't had the presence of mind to ask, they can go ahead and give them as well. We'll all appreciate it. Then we'll take questions from the floor. In San Francisco, as you know, we avoid the expression "open the floor to questions." So, Audrey, let me start with a
that was a huge jinx.
Let me also remind you, if you have phones, you're welcome to tweet. We're open to the public, but please turn off your ringers because this is being recorded to be both for audio and televising. Audrey, I wanted to confront you in a sense and congratulate you because I have this copy, which I'll hold this up to the microphone for the people at home listening on radio. But this is an exceptional series of journalism of reporting that the Chronicle did in 2003 called Shame of the Cities, written primarily by Kevin Fagan, who's still, thank goodness, on your staff. And it is as powerful and as beautifully done and as compelling a body of journalism as I've seen on homelessness anywhere. And so congratulations to the Chronicle for this. But then, if this was 2003,
yeah, it didn't
why
work.
Did we have to do this?
Well, you know, you're right. Kevin's been covering this issue for the better part of two decades now. For anyone who doesn't know Kevin, you should, because he's really an amazing journalist. One of the first things he ever told me was a story about getting pigeon mites. I don't know how many people know what pigeon mites are, but they're little mites that live on pigeons. And when you're homeless and you live on the streets, you get them. Kevin and one of our photographers, Brant Ward, who shot that project, lived on the streets virtually as homeless people, almost full time, not seeing their families for 6 months. And they were so covered in pigeon mites, Kevin's wife wouldn't let him come in the house until he took off all of his clothes in the garage. And I'm sure he's thrilled that I'm telling that story. But I think, you know, it does demonstrate the extent to which that we've covered this issue over the decades. It's one that's inextricably linked to San Francisco in as much the same way as the Golden Gate Bridge and cable cars are.
Set us up a little bit. How did this come about?
Well, like all good journalism stories, it starts in a bar with actually Clara and another editor, Matt Honan, who's the editor of BuzzFeed SF. And I think all of our spouses were out of town or something. And and we were talking about local politics, and I told an anecdote about a local politician that I think Clara was quite entertained by. And her response, as I remember it, was, you know, we should really do something all together. And at the time I thought, well, that would blow people's mind. BuzzFeed, The Chronicle, and Mother Jones. Like, you can't find three more different publications maybe in the city. And I, you know, I kind of tucked away. And then in maybe 5 weeks later, one of the things I do for our subscribers, which you all should be, is they get tours of the newsroom by me once a month. And on this particular tour, now this is in the middle of the day on a work day. People have to take off work or they're retired or take off school. So these are really some of the most dedicated subscribers and readers that we have. And we were walking through the newsroom, the windows were open, and there's a gentleman that maybe some of you know who goes around with a bullhorn. And he's very aggressively sort of angry sounding, and he yells about Jesus. I think most of you know who I'm talking about. It was so distracting, I lost my train of thought. And one of the people on the tour said, you know, you should really do a story about the solutions to homelessness. And I felt like I had been punched in the face because, of course, we do those stories weekly. And from my perspective, it means we're not getting through this noise. The problem with this problem is everybody thinks they understand it. And so I thought, well, I've only had a giant newsroom. And then I thought, my newsroom isn't giant enough. And I thought back about that night at the bar and thought, well, if I could get 10 of other editors on board, that would be great. And voila, we say it's more than 70, but the amazing thing about today is I was getting emails from editors that I didn't even know were part of the project. So just in the Bay Area, we're probably at more than 90 now. And today was also repeated in Seattle, in LA, and San Diego is doing one. Dallas is doing one, Iowa, DC.
Wow. So it sounds as though what you're saying is the problem is a scarcity of coverage. So Clara Jeffrey, let me ask you, you would think on the surface, it would seem that homelessness is a story that is affecting thousands of people directly, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people indirectly, and that it certainly affects their experience of living in a city. There's drama, there's loss, there's tragedy. There are all the elements of good, compelling news. So what is it that keeps the media from being all over homelessness in a consistent way?
I'm not sure that that's really the problem. I think, like another topic, which Mother Jones has been a leader in collaborating on, which is climate change, I think it's more that the problem seems immense, intractable. What can one person do? What can one news organization do? Too complicated to wrap your head around. And I think both news organizations sometimes, but also readers just sort of throw their hands up. And I think what's nice about coming together in these big efforts is a couple of things. One, you know, I mean, I think Audrey was saying earlier, there are 150 stories published today, and there's more to come, people. So that's a lot of coverage. But also that every news organization comes at it with a different approach. So there are organizations like Matt's at BuzzFeed, which have done, you know, interactives today. There are people that are taking deep data dives. There are big, intensive photographic essays. And then, of course, there's amazing audio pieces done by KQED and other radio stations and podcasts. So I think in that way, it allows different parts of the potential audience to hear the story that will speak to them the most. I think in this case also, one of the things that, you know, quickly came to our minds was both the city's citizens and possibly its politicians also feel overwhelmed. And I think feeling overwhelmed can turn to a sort of acceptance and then ultimately apathy. And this size of an effort can kind of jar people out of that.
Well, let me ask Gary Camilla, because now your publication is a city magazine. And it relies on glossy advertising and selling lifestyle and five places to get a great martini and that kind of story. It wouldn't seem that your advertisers are clamoring for up-close and personal stories about seriously destitute people living on the streets.
No.
So what kind of, tell me about the conversations that were going on or that would be going on or that you would expect to have to confront in overcoming certain resistance. You're advertising, but your resistance from your audience.
Yeah, I mean, actually, the funny thing is I wrote a piece that I think was the longest piece that has ever run in San Francisco Magazine last year on homelessness. I
Great
filed
piece.
It at 13,000 words. I think it ran at 10,000 words. And the cover of that magazine was fashion. And it showed a lovely nymph in like fall colors, spring colors. And it was pretty jarring. And, you know, this is the world we live in. You know, this glossy magazines make money by selling ads. We are fortunate enough that we have not had, you know, our publishers, our publisher and the people that run the magazine don't come down and say, oh, you can't run a 10,000 word piece on homelessness. Obviously, you know, we're not going to run a steady diet of 10,000 word pieces on homelessness. But it's the fact is that we cover the waterfront in that magazine. And I'm not trying to make it sound like we're, you know, we walk on water in this magazine, but this is an issue that is central to San Francisco. And the reason that we're also grateful that Audrey came up with this idea for all of us to do this together and for all of these media outlets to take it on is that this is an issue. It's like trying to deal with this, as I found out during this long reporting on that piece, there isn't any issue more intractable and more difficult, and that involves more different aspects of sociology, of politics, of psychology, of every aspect of life comes together on this in this tragic way, and we're really dealing with a legacy of our failure as a society, and that's one of the reasons it's so difficult for any media outlet to get their handle on this. It's like you're trying to, you know, take on something that has so many causes, and these causes are deeply rooted in all of the things that are the most unfortunate things about this great country. And, you know, things that we should not be proud of and things that we need to change. And they're not easy to write about and they're very complicated. And so, you know, I just think that the more I echo what Clara said, the fact that we have these hundreds of stories up now, I don't expect everyone here or everyone who's watching this to read all of those stories, but all you have to do is read a few of them and you start to get the sense of the gravity of the problem, the breadth of the problem, and some of the solutions. And the more you read, there are solutions. I'm not saying we can solve this problem. I don't believe there's a silver bullet entirely. Although Kevin Fagan made an excellent argument in today's Chronicle that if we came up with an amount of money that isn't undoable, we might be able to get ahead of it. I'm not convinced that that's totally true, but we could certainly take steps. And that's one of the things that I think this kind of journalistic effort is really good for, is it actually gets engagement, it gets hope, and hopefully gets politicians, policymakers, and the general public engaged to really try to solve this national disgrace.
That's very hopeful. I mean, I would just tell you, I used Kevin Fagan's series from 2003 for about 10 years when I was teaching a course on journalism and poverty. And he made much the same proposals.
Right.
And they now they're going to listen to
They made sense then. They make sense now.
Well, yeah.
So let me ask you a little bit of sort of shop talk, if you like. You all are associated with very proud, very independent journalism organizations. And you do terrific work. You don't normally waive your sovereignty. You don't normally, and journalists are not known for playing well with each other. They generally pride themselves in their independence and going it alone. So I'm wondering, QED, you've got a pretty good news operation. What did it take? What were the conversations like to agree, to get folks to sort of agree that, well, let's all be rowing in the same direction with the people we normally compete with?
So this is what was sort of shocking and revolutionary about this coming together of all these media organizations. Audrey kind of called a number of people. I was one of them and said, hey, let's have a beer. And we do this periodically and conspire.
I don't always hang out in beers.
Yes, she does.
But it is handy sometimes.
Every one of our meetings has involved a beer. I'm outing you here. So she proposed this with a little bit of trepidation, you know. Oh, and for us, for a public broadcaster, we're fortunate in the fortunate position of being mission-driven, right? We're not about competition with other outlets. We're about public service. So for us, it was a no-brainer. We didn't need to be convinced, right? So we held the first meeting with media organizations at KQED sort of for that reason. It felt like neutral ground. We were used to collaborating with a number of the people in the room. But what was surprising about this first meeting, so we had in our boardroom, we had about 40 media outlets gathered around. We had had a little bit of wine and food.
There was no beer available.
That's unholy.
And so we got everybody into the room, and Audrey was really nervous.
I was more scared than I can talk to an arena full of people, but 40 editors are scary.
It was really funny. It was surprising. So she puts the proposition on the table. And you know, what you had told me in private was you were really worried that people would, you know, think, no, we can't do this, we can't come together. What was just shocking about this gathering was what everybody did. There was almost no poo-pooing of the idea whatsoever. Everybody immediately said, oh, no, let's do a lot more than that. What else, you know, let's do it for a whole year. Let's really, I mean, it was crazy. We had to sort of tamp down everybody's enthusiasm and say, you know, let's do something that's not a heavy lift so that we can see how this goes. And I think that it's partly the moment of media that we're in, the winnowing down of so many of the for-profit publications in particular, and, you know, the dawning on us of the importance of the Fourth Estate and what we do in terms of pushing public information and conversations forward and asking tough questions and trying to answer them. But yeah, the enthusiasm was insane. It was really surprising. And as in our news organization and at my dinner table and in conversations with friends, all of us were asking these questions. And, you know, we've been covering this for decades, right? And we cover it in an ongoing basis. And you start to feel like you're just stepping over somebody who's lying in the street, and you're becoming inured to this crisis because it's been with us for so long, and it does feel like it's so intractable. And so we were having these conversations in our newsroom about how do we cover this and what's the best way to tell this story, you know, every week. And so I think that's happening to everybody. And so there was just this coalescing of, yeah, we're going to do this.
Well, I hope this doesn't sound too inside baseball, but I'm just curious, did you have a unified agenda? Did you have a story budget?
Holly's in charge of writing my agendas after this.
I do the agenda. No, here's the thing.
How did you prevent there from being overlap?
There's absolutely overlap. So here was the ask.
I thought I was the only one who noticed.
The ask was simply that we would come together on a day or a week, and each media organization would agree to cover this issue in their own fashion, right? So that's the part that was not the heavy lift. We were trying to do something where we didn't have to have an agenda, where you were trying to serve your audiences in the best way that you knew how, use the resources that you had. We put together a couple of groups, like a data journalism group and an engagement group, so that we could have some shared resources if people wanted them. The SF Gate agreed to do a page with everybody's stories on it. And that's actually a lot of work. And organizing this whole thing has been a lot of work. That's why we were like, no, just one day. And Medium put up a page so that we could feature everybody's work there. But I think the beauty of the project was you do this in your own way.
So what do you think so far? From what you've seen, I don't know how much of other people's work you've actually read. I gather you all have been pretty much absorbed in the work of your own staffs. But from what you see, what do you think?
Well, our stories were done you know, a couple of weeks ago, actually, because we, you know, we have to have them copy edited. We have to put them, you know, do all the online stuff, our interactive. So the concept, the reporting, the editing was done a long time ago. Today was for me really surreal because I cleared my schedule and I was posting everything on the project's social media pages along with, Otis, Taylor from Ripple and Brandon Mercer, our executive producer of SF Gate. And the three of us could not keep up with the totality of the emails coming in with everybody's links. It was I like almost started crying at my desk a few times because it was just so overwhelmingly amazing. It has exceeded all expectations by far.
I would second that. The other thing that was that blew me away this week was all of the people contacting me over the last 3 days and saying, how can I help? Researchers who wanted to be part of the, like so many people that it was, I stayed up until 10 o'clock just trying to respond to people almost every night this week. And then people who would call and tell me their stories. And I think a lot of the stories in this iteration of the collaboration were about the visible homeless. But so many people called me and said, I live in my car. Nobody knows that I'm homeless. I'm a student. And so trying to kind of do the second phase of this and tell more of those stories of the invisible, people who are living on the edge of homelessness, I think is another really big piece of this. But a lot of people just wanted to say, there's this stereotype of what life on the streets looks like, frequently mental illness and substance abuse, and those things are true. But people saying, my story is that I have a job, I do not have a substance abuse problem, and I just don't have enough money to put a down payment on a house, on a home, on a place to live.
Before we totally exit the shop talk, I think there is one thing we should mention, which is, you know, from my perspective, what's amazing about this and amazing about all of my colleagues everywhere else agreeing to try this experiment is, you know, the public opinion polls put journalists down there with, like, politicians and trial lawyers. Like, we're way down here, right? And I just think this is such a remarkable display of why we all become journalists, which is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable and to... you know, speak truth to power. The day the news came out about this project, the mayor called me on my cell phone and he said, Audrey, what are you doing? And I said, Mayor, what are you doing? I joked about it, but you've seen this week more politicians saying the word homelessness than you've seen probably in the last 4 years. And there's lots of reasons for that. We had a recession. There were a lot of things that the city had other priorities. But now it's time for us to say, no, this is what we need to do. Because at the end of the day, it makes, you know, I became a journalist because I believe that us explaining to you all what you need to know to help govern your community is the most righteous thing that we could possibly do. And, you know, I like to tell people, you're not entitled to an uninformed opinion. You're not allowed to have it. And after today, I don't think anybody can say they have an uninformed opinion anymore.
You know, as much as we have done today, that the real measure of the sort of journalistic effort is we've done a lot to launch a lot of conversations and to dislodge some political action and to unearth some data. To my mind, the real work is yet to come. Things have been put into motion both by us and for us and in City Hall and elsewhere. And so what we can do to sort of chronicle any change that does or does not come out of this action, I think, is the obvious next chapter. And there are so many stories, individual like Holly mentioned, that are you could dive into forever. And each one of us is going to sort of have to pick our mark, where we think we can make our mark.
So Claire, what does success look like?
I think success, in part, really looks like having a better handle on some pretty basic information. We all have written some version of the how many homeless are there? Is it really rising? Is it more visible? Is it just yuppies who take more notice of it? Is it moving from one neighborhood to another? It's not like journalists can answer all of those questions. We can't, but we can demand answers to those questions. And I think we will not get all of them, but we can get more of them than the city has now.
But you framed your answer to my question in terms of information availability rather than action. And isn't the point, isn't this laden with a call to action? And if that action doesn't materialize, it's to some degree, wouldn't you have to say that the project has not succeeded?
Nope.
I mean, I don't know about that. It's journalists' job to demand the information, to unearth the information. It is then constituents' jobs to make sure that action is taken. You know, we are not the ones who will put the policy into motion. We can unearth things that might suggest good policy. We can even advocate for policy, but we're not going to be the ones who make the policy.
So you agree? You all are okay with that? If the city goes turns back over and goes back to sleep, that's
not what I said.
Right. Yeah, no. Yeah, you're just
it's our job to stay on them, but you know, but we are not going to be the ones to actually, put the policy into action.
From my point of view, we live in the most innovative city on the planet. We have changed this world since the gold rush, you know, over and over again. What is intolerable to me is that we seem to have run out of ideas to approach this. So as long as, you know, this city deserves a media that's going to continue to be innovative, and it deserves leaders that are going to continue to be innovative. And when we run out of new things to try, that's when we failed. So I think by keeping the pressure up, by continuing to inform people about what works and what doesn't, we force the people who are charged with leading us to continue to be innovative, which is what we should all expect.
I just want to push back a little bit. The ideas are there. We know how to house people. We know how to build houses. We know how to give them beds. There's 7,000 people. It's not...
Maybe. There might be...
lot more than 7,000 people. Again, those are the people that may be living on the streets or in shelters.
Right.
But there is a huge problem of income inequality and housing affordability in this community and in a lot of others. And there are so many invisible people who are not visible to this that are living on the edge of a crisis. And part of it has to do with structural inequality in our society. I think that's the piece that we didn't get to, really. It has to do with income inequality. It has to do with people locked out of wealth and assets for generations, and then suddenly we are pretending that there's an even playing field in our society. So there's a lot of issues that are wrapped up in this.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously the solution to homelessness is homes. I mean, that's like the Webster's definition of it. But, you know, the city will show you data that says 4% of the shelter beds are unoccupied every night. You know, whether or not you believe that, there is some capacity in the system. Do we want people living in shelters where they live for 90 days and have to line up with their kids at 7 o'clock in the morning? Is that the sort of community we want? Do we want everybody to have an apartment? I mean, there's a lot of, yes, we have to house people. How you do that, how you keep it in them, how you address the root causes of how they got there in the first place. That's why I everybody who says, oh, well, this is really a simple thing, and anyone who tells you it's not just about money is lying to you. I mean, that's ridiculous. We should be more intellectually curious as a community to really probe these things, and then more importantly, to be able to have a civic discussion about it without people being afraid of being called intolerant or hating homeless people. There's no person, I'm getting my soapbox, now I'm getting mad. There's no person, you're wondering, I just needed a little coffee. There's no person in this region who wants people to live on the streets. We should just get over that and stop with this terrible in the gutter dialogue that we have right now and discuss what works. Is this okay? Are we okay with having a mother and her children line up at 7 a.m. to try to get a 90-day space? I'm supposed to be a neutral journalist, but I will say I am not okay with that. And I don't think, you know, that's speaking truth to power. Yeah, she can get a home. Is it one we want, and is it going to keep her off the street?
So what has the feedback been from the public? Not the professional advocates, not the
I like to say that me and the Muni director are the only people in San Francisco who everybody thinks they can do their job better than you. So
may maybe the mayor.
Which is great. which actually I joke about, but is really great because it shows that people care and are invested in what we do. And I have to say, I've never gotten so much, seen so much positive reaction, which tells me this community is really hungry for this information. I don't know, maybe.
We got all kinds of positive. I mean, you know, we also got the naysayers, just give them a bus ticket out. So, for the most part, we do, as a city, incidentally, give bus tickets.
So why has this thoughtful
and positive comments from people and really earnest ideas about how to solve this, questions about how can I pitch in, how can we come together. So I think that there's real energy around that.
Well, and I think one of the things that Audrey was saying earlier is like to point out that there is a problem, to point out that this is awful, to point out that it's appalling when you walk down the street. It's not to demonize the poor or criminalize the homeless. Like, if you're not willing to say this is a problem, you're never going to have a solution. And I think that we sometimes tip into that. And then on the other hand, I think we just have a feeling like, well, what can I do? And so this is an effort to recharge journalists and news organizations, but I think it's also an effort to recharge the public. You know, San Francisco by itself is not going to solve national or even regional income inequality, structural housing and transit problems, meth and opioid addiction, et cetera, et cetera. It's not going to solve schizophrenia. But we can figure out which kind of services we can deliver more efficiently, what the bottlenecks are, what we can do. There's only 10 cities in America that constitute one-third of the homeless population. We need to ask questions about why that is. Why those 10 cities? What are they doing or not doing? Yeah, sure, it's warm and it's a nice place to live. But that's not the only reason. Is it because we're relatively tolerant of the homeless? That may be part of it, but maybe it's also something that we're not doing, some good that we're not doing. So I think all of those questions are things that we can help lead the public to asking more probative questions of policymakers.
I'm curious about your reaction to the observation that the media should not be in the business of crusading and advocating, and that this came up a year or so ago when The Guardian in London decided it took a strong position with respect to divestment of stocks in fossil fuel companies and allied itself with Bill McKibben and the Leave It in the Ground movement, and said that as a matter of news judgment, they would be looking for stories that supported that because they thought that the moral challenge was just too great to fail to take on. And it received very little publicity in this country, that position, let alone imitators. It wasn't even publicized. But this is a problem, not a problem, but this is an issue that I promise you the journalists of tomorrow and the ones who are going into your new news organizations over the next few years are wrestling with now. What is the appropriate role of advocacy for, you know, principled journalism?
I don't think that what we're doing is advocacy. I think we are doing our job, and our job is, as the fourth estate, to hold politicians accountable, to convene critical conversations, to give people information so that they can make choices and ask these questions. We are just doing our job. We have a role in society, and that's this. We're not saying to you, San Francisco, the solution is X, and we're going to crusade about this until it's done. That is not what we're doing. We're telling the story so that you can get a sense of the breadth of humanity behind the word that we say, the homeless. We're trying to give you a sense of the context that this has been going on for over 30 years, and asking the question, why? Why are we, you know, why do we seem to be doing some of the same things, which is focus on really temporary shelter, focus on continuing to have these super users of our emergency rooms, for example, and spending a ton of money on that. Is that rational? We're just asking these questions and also giving you quantifying the numbers for you. Where are we spending that $241 million every year in San Francisco? And I feel like this week I had this graduate level education in what's happening and understanding it. And, you know, just found out a lot of really interesting things. Like San Rafael says that they have per capita a far higher homeless population than San Francisco. Yeah. So this is the job of journalism, in my opinion, and I don't think that this should be so controversial. I think a lot of people want to frame it as, you know, advocacy, but a good journalist doesn't leave you sort of just with, well, here's a problem. We're also examining, well, what have they done in Utah that seems to be a national model? And ask the question, is there something we can learn from that? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But we're giving information and we're bringing people together to have conversations, to hash it out, to have, you know, civil discussions and disagreements, and also to put a real face on what has just become sort of this idea of a body laid out in the street.
I guess I think that's all true, Holly. I maybe lean a little bit more towards splitting the difference in terms of how much advocacy drives us. Advocacy obviously is kind of a dirty word in journalism. It's like you have a specific cause and you're going to like the Guardian thing. It's, you know, it's very, and yeah, I don't think we're driven because we have one given solution that we all want to promulgate or support. But I think what Audrey was saying, I think what all of us have said in one way or another, even if we don't explicitly put on an advocate hat, we are, as journalists, we're human beings also. We're driven by passion. We're driven by moral outrage. We're driven by the things that ever, we're not, when we become journalists, we don't put on this sort of cloak of neutrality where we're just, you know, absolutely like computer-like, here's information we're passing out. Every choice we make as a journalist, as an editor, as a writer involves value judgments. And of course, the key distinction to me is that as a journalist, you have to be trained to be scrupulously fair in dealing with all evidence, no matter what you believe. And if the evidence doesn't support your passion, your belief, then you have to like change your belief. But that doesn't mean that the sense of, oh my God, I can't believe that this country has come to this, that like, you know, I did a piece on North Beach Citizens, this very small outfit, and North Beach does great work. And Christy Fairchild, the executive director, said, you know, that there are these Dutch, Dutch kids came in and said, your country is disgraceful. You know, I mean, it's just like an outsider comes in and just says, this is like unacceptable. And I think we all feel that. That doesn't mean that we then get on our soapbox. It's not like we're all going to run 100 op-eds saying this must change, although there's certainly room for op-eds. That's part of journalism, too. But I think behind a lot of the investigative reporting, the nitty-gritty reporting we're doing, and, you know, I don't think Holly and I probably disagree about this, is that we all, you know, we're searching, we're driven by a passionate desire to make a difference, and we want to be fair about it, but there is that sense that this is something that we care deeply about, and we're also citizens of the city and citizens of this country and human beings as well as being journalists.
Yeah, I would just add, I mean, I think journalism has its central mission to be scrupulously fair, but the sort of canard of objective journalism was really born of an era when journalism was made almost exclusively by white men and dockers. You know, people have points of view. People come to every single argument with subjectivity. But it's our job to sort of weigh the evidence and, not unlike a scientist, to Gary's point, like, look at what's out there and then come to some conclusions. If your conclusion is then later invalidated or disproven to some extent, then you come up with a new sort of theory of how things are working. So I think that there's, you know, that part of our job is to really, conduct a scientific investigation of what is and could happen in this city.
Well, I take your point, and certainly no one would want to see journalism that regards their obligation to give equal time to argue in favor of starvation and disease. That would be lunacy. But as has often been said, the power of the media consists not so much in telling you what to think, but in telling you what to think about. And plainly, a huge, passionate commitment went into deciding that this, above all the issues affecting this community, is the one that we want to rivet people's attention to. And I just think that that's something that is worth discussing. It's worth putting out there and subjecting to critique. I mean, homeless people are not representative of the poor. Yeah, there's a huge, just as Holly was saying, I really applaud what you just said a few moments ago. I mean, we have a far greater, far more intense population that suffers from deprivation that are not on the streets. They work because they're not being paid enough, and they suffer the shortened life expectancies, and their kids suffer, and all the rest of it. Those people go in the millions, go unnoticed. And the attention goes to this desperately damaged population of homeless people, which heaven knows regards our, deserve our compassion, deserve the attention you've given them. But I'm just pointing out that that's a choice.
Well, I think that's actually a really interesting question that I don't know that any of us have the complete answer to, which is, you know, what percentage of the homeless are working poor who have, via eviction and other recent economic downturns, fallen into homelessness versus a more chronic homeless population that struggles with addiction and mental illness and so forth. I mean, there's a rough idea of the breakdown, but whenever you get into the numbers too closely, there's some squishiness there. And I think that's one of the things that this project hopes to investigate better.
Well, and I would posit that there may be other issues that we take on in this similar fashion.
Well, yeah. Funny.
We're just getting started, Ed.
Well, go ahead. Come on, give us some news. What do you think the next area of comparable collaboration might be?
We're not going to be able to give that secret away right here. You're going to have to stay
tuned. Holly has ideas.
I do have ideas.
We have to discuss.
We're going to have our next meeting.
In about 3 minutes, we're going to go to the floor and take questions. There's a microphone over there, if you wouldn't mind. If you have questions, just queue up there and just keep them short. No filibustering. And make sure they are questions. So they should end with question marks. So, but we'll go to that in a moment.
Can I just tell you one other thing that I thought was really wonderful in terms of this project for me? We found a documentary that KQED did from 1982 when the word homeless was just kind of being coined. And what was so interesting is it almost feels like it could have been produced last week. But there were, I think the count was 700 people, and mostly living in cars and vans at that time. But it coincided with releasing people from mental hospitals, so that was a really big deal, and the recession, and you know, kind of the end of the industrial job era in San Francisco and in the Bay Area. So it was just that documentary just blew me away.
Would you regard it as a mark of success of this project if homelessness became part of the political dialogue in the coming electoral season?
It's already happening.
It
already is.
Is it?
I mean, yeah. The mayor yesterday opened the second navigation center. It's not a coincidence that happened yesterday. It was supposed to happen late this week or next week. I mean, that's today. Filting in the legislature proposed a resolution to declare to ask the governor to declare a statewide state of emergency. I don't think that would have happened otherwise. So it's already moving.
Would you expect people to be running for office in part on the basis of a determination to come up with solutions to?
I expect people who are running for office to have innovative ideas about how to solve the issues in this community. And hopefully after this week, we've given them some.
All right. Shall we go to questions from the floor?
Thank you. A friend of mine lives on Nob Hill and is paying $540 a month for a one-bedroom apartment.
Wow.
Well, this is the reason that, like in Northridge earthquake and when fires happen, a lot of owners of buildings they want to take the insurance money if they have it and leave the buildings empty. So what do you cover that about how many and the internet people that are coming up to making Silicon Valley here that displace a lot of people from their rent-controlled apartments?
Well, I mean, we've all covered the issues of particularly fires in the Mission, I think, are the most suspicious right now, whether all those fires that have displaced people are sketchy and what's going to happen to those people, some of whom were homeless when they moved into that place and find themselves in the same. And there has been, even before this project was announced, interest in the city to keep people in their homes. I mean, the best way to prevent homelessness is to keep people from losing their homes. So, yeah, it's a hard one. And, you know, we saw today with the proposal of the tech company tax, which we're going to vote on perhaps. And also, I'm forgetting what the other thing was that happened this week.
Mark Farrell's proposal.
I mean, so there's a lot of things coming. Oh, yeah. I know I was going to say the Airbnb lawsuits and legislation. I mean, we have a lot of complicated housing issues facing this city.
And we just have an appalling lack of housing kind of at every level below luxury level. But that includes, you know, a lot of people who don't want any more density in their neighborhoods, including the entire western half of the city, the entire peninsula, the entire East Bay. We're not going to get out of a chronic housing problem, of which homelessness is a part of, without building more housing. And people really don't want to accept that. They don't want their views blocked. They worry about the impact to their commute. Well, listen, our commutes are already terrible. And the only way they're, you know, that too is going to get better is to put more effort and more pressure to build better transit systems of all kinds. So we can't just solve or even attempt to try and chronicle homelessness without attacking and chronicling the larger housing infrastructure problem that this region has.
Thank you.
So congratulations. The project is fantastic, and I'm really impressed. And, you know, what struck me from what Gary and Clara both said is that, of course, you're journalists and you're covering this, but you're also humans. And so I would love to know from each of you what your most recent encounter with a homeless person was and how you responded.
Well, I went by Glide. We'll go down the line. I was walking by Glide the other day, and I have to say, I've decided anytime I'm feeling like fat or ugly, I'm going to walk by Glide because all of the people out there are like, girlfriend, your shoes are great. And it is the best thing for your self-esteem ever. And I was just like, thank you. Gosh, this is the best place to hang out in all of San Francisco. So that was my last one. You have great shoes too, Gary.
Oh, thank you. Boy, I've taken on a project of just coming up to homeless people on the street and interviewing them, and I've done a whole bunch of them, and they've been all over the map. That's been a really eye-opening process. But the one, a guy I talked to just yesterday or a couple days ago, was an extraordinary guy. Just so many of these stories are just, you've never heard them before. This was a guy, he called himself a rubber tramp. And rubber tramps are guys who ride on bikes and are homeless. And he lived mostly in the Presidio for 27 years with his bike, which he all kind of disguised with big black bags. And thanks to this outfit that I wrote about, North Beach Citizens, he's actually housed now, although he's still having to get used to being inside, which is a huge issue with homeless people. But he was an extraordinary guy. He was kind of like, you know, weirdly unfazed. It was like, in one part of him, it was like he was camping that whole time. So really extraordinary stories, but everyone is different. And that's one of the amazing things about going out and talking to them. It's just like every story is different.
I live in the Mission, and we've had a real explosion, at least of visibly homeless people, even before folks were moved off Division Street. But, you know, I walk to work often, kind of one of two routes, one that takes me down Market and the other that takes me down Folsom. And, you know, the Market route, we've all seen the mid-market development. In my neighborhood on Folsom Street, you know, there are tent encampments everywhere. And these range from folks who, you know, seem, you know, pretty destitute and out of it. And there's a lot of drug use to just like some wonderful family that I met the other day where a woman was just trying to take care of her two little kids. And it's heartbreaking, you know, and I think every day on that walk, I feel like every mix of emotion from being appalled and so sad and horrified and guilty. And I think that in a sense, is what all the journalists that came together to do this project have been feeling in experiences both more shallow and more in-depth with their encounters with the homeless. It's just like this whole range of emotions, and just seeing this problem get, you know, markedly worse. It feels like even in the last, when I first moved here 16 years ago, and I'd lived in New York and DC, I was like, oh my God, it's so bad here. And it is so much worse today. And it's so much worse 2 years ago than, today than it was 2 years ago. So
most of my experiences with homeless individuals on the streets are pretty shallow. It's me saying hello or giving somebody a buck or leftovers. But this week I've been talking to a lot more people because they're calling me and asking me to tell their stories. And so one that stuck out was a young woman who aged out of foster care, she's in college, and she just doesn't have enough money to put the big chunk of change down on her own apartment. So those are the stories that have been really moving me lately, is not the people that you're seeing on the streets. But I think that this project has changed the way that I look at the people even laying on the streets. So.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you very much for this incredible collaboration. We followed the lives of homeless recyclers in Oakland over 7 years for a documentary called Dogtown Redemption.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was very interesting is that we focus on the homeless, but it was very interesting to see the places where the homeless were interacting with the city. And so, for instance, the hospital, the jail, housing, and so on. And I'm wondering whether this collaboration that you've started gives us an opportunity to rethink our ideas of the city, the way the city's structured, the way budgets are structured, so that some money goes to housing, some money goes somewhere else, and that kind of deep integration that needs to happen at the level of the city and others isn't really happening. And I'm wondering if you can broaden your collaboration beyond your profession, journalism, and bring in government officials, doctors, and so on, and sort of create almost like a crisis group or some focus group where we can draw on all that experience, because there is a wealth of knowledge, in at least in Oakland and so on. And so I'm just wondering if we can do that integrated thing and rethink the city. Thank you. Oh, and also we have free DVDs for people outside.
Yeah, great film. I think it's a great idea. I don't think that's for us to do. I think that's for you to do. I think that's for somebody else to pick up and do, but I think it's a fabulous idea. I also think, you know, another question that should be asked is the best way to run a city with long-term planning to have politicians who generally have very short-term agendas running the show? And maybe we need to rethink that entire dynamic.
Well, and just to get a better handle on what is being done, where are the costs? The places that have been really successful in starting to turn the tide, I think, are the ones that get better information of all the services that are being used, that figure out which individuals can be stabilized at huge cost savings. You know, the average homeless person in Santa Clara, for example, costs about $80,000 a year. But there are 26 individuals who cost $300,000+ a year. Now, you stabilize the people who are using the most services, you save money, you help them, and you can plow that money back into other housing and outreach efforts. And I think the places that are doing that effectively, it's not the only answer, but we can't attack this piecemeal. We have to have policies that look at the overall and really trying to come up with a holistic attempt at assessment and service delivery.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And the good news is that the city, as I'm sure you all know, just created a new Department of Homelessness with a very respected head, Jeff Kaczynski, mm-hmm. who was the head of Hamilton Family Center, which is an excellent, very efficient nonprofit that houses homeless families. And one thing you learn when you talk to these guys is the best practices, the term of art for what is the best way. It's like client-based, meeting the homeless where they are, delivering immediate services, figuring out these really intimate interactions at a ground level where the city's involved, getting down, and the city gets down on its knees instead of being up in a bureaucratic silo, and being able to get the information. We've all talked about information delivery. Now, it's not going to be that easy, but Kaczynski's charge is basically to deliver information in a way that has never, it's been siloized between HSA and Department of Health. And, you know, they don't keep the same records, and the nonprofits don't keep the same records. So there's reason for guarded optimism with this guy with a good background coming in, that we're going to have better information, and that some of these best practices that really are known by a lot of people that work in this field, about especially about the modalities of counseling, mm-hmm. and how you have to, it's a long-term one-to-one engagement with trust, respect. It's not about putting people in houses.
And
you
it's
know,
not
that, you got to put them in houses, but then you got to stay with them, especially the chronically homeless, because they're quite damaged in general and they need help. And so the best people in this field, they all know it, which is a good thing. And now it's about getting all the bureaucracies to pull together, and maybe the city, this is the advocacy piece, maybe if we say, I would certainly say at this point, having spent hundreds of millions of dollars, well, over a billion now, pass a $200 million bond measure. You know, say we're gonna like do this huge bond measure, and we're gonna see if we can get ahead of this. If we screw up, well, we've just blown 1 year's budget that goes down the tubes anyway. So you know, I think that there's reason to try that.
Yeah, right. Not make sobriety a prerequisite
right.
for services, and especially
yeah.
housing. You know,
right.
someone once said to me a long time right. ago, who was a writer who worked on mental health, like, are the homeless, do crazy people wind up on the streets, or do you become mentally ill from living on the streets? I mean,
yeah.
it's not a chicken or egg,
yeah.
but, you know, you can't dictate that people need to be sober to get a house.
Right.
Thanks. We have time for only two more questions, I'm afraid.
Hi. I work for GLIDE. And I am so grateful to be here. I have watched this coverage. I've watched all of you cover homeless issues for many, many years. And I spent 20 years in media before I came to GLIDE. So I just want to thank you for the work and for humanizing homelessness. And as journalists, I know there's not one person to blame, but who's going to rewrite the legacy of Ronald Reagan?
Mm. No.
That is my question.
I would only sadly have to add one unfortunate caveat to that. You're absolutely right, and Reagan bears the lion's share of the blame for eviscerating the federal housing budget. Sadly, Jimmy Carter actually began that process. So we got Jimmy Carter, I think, was a very maligned and pretty good president.
He also closed the mental health institutions
yeah,
here
right.
in the state of California in the late 70s.
Yeah. Well, Reagan, yes, Reagan did.
There's
yeah.
a lot
oh, no,
to
no.
put there.
Oh, no, no, I'm not trying to defend Reagan. I'm just throwing
That's
a little...
That's what I heard, Gary.
Right. No, I'm throwing a little blame towards Carter. All right.
Thank you.
Hi, I also work in support of housing in the Tenderloin, and you know, being there every day, I truly appreciate, as well as my coworkers, we appreciate everything that came about because of, you know, the media taking this effort to put such a reporting view on all of this. I realize though that you're also in a really difficult spot because with the public, if you report too much on something, they get irritated and they kind of turn a deaf ear to it. So it's a fine balance. So one of the things that topics of discussion that came up amongst my coworkers and myself was, what plan do you have to report in a manner that keeps a spotlight on this, but yet without becoming so annoying that people get tired of hearing about it and our politicians get sick of hearing about it?
Well, I it's funny because when I started recruiting like print and safe people that I knew, and the people that were kind of scary to me were the TV editor, my colleagues in TV, because I didn't know them as well. And one of them, who ultimately signed on for not only the day but has done an entire week, said to me, "Well, yeah, homeless stories don't do well in the burbs." And I thought, Well, how about TV people? No, but I do think there is a risk of too many sad stories that all sound the same. They all, you know, we need to bring something new to it. But that's the beauty of this one day thing, because originally what I told everybody was, you know, we should aim for a day where you can't turn on Twitter or Facebook or anything without seeing a story. You cannot escape it, and it's going to be smart, and it's going to tell you something that you didn't know. And that's all we can really expect from people, is to just try a little bit. But it's easy in this world where, you know, media is so diffuse to be able to escape that. I mean, you all are here, you know, in the Commonwealth Club. You're not the problem people, but you know, we live busy lives, and it's easy to do that. So I think, you know, today was exhausting if you watched all of it, which, you know, you and the services community probably did, but most people probably didn't see all of that. You know, I, from my perspective, I hope you're sick of seeing it on the front page every day. On Sunday, we're going to do something that we've never done, which is it's just going to be one long editorial. The photo is like this big. You're going to see a front page that has words on it, and it's going to be scary. And I don't care, because we do it 365 days a year, and this is important enough. And, you know, sometimes you need to get in people's face and tell them what they need to know.
Look. There's an informed tradition, which is that we close these panels by the moderator asking all of our panelists the following question. What is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Audrey?
When you said that this was a question, it scared the you-know-what out of me, because I thought, I just did it. I thought, I have to come up with another one? When I was a kid, I thought it was the most... nobody steal this. Food tape. We need food tape. Like when your taco falls apart or your hot dog falls apart. I came up with the inspiration for the Homeless Project and food tape. But this is I have 30 seconds left. My other idea is I'm going to get you all to believe in local media and tell you that if you believe in what this project did, I'd love for you to subscribe to the Chronicle. We need it. Otherwise, you know, we can't survive. But you need to put your money where your mouth is and financially support it with your eyeballs too. So that, my idea to save the world is that you all, you know, support local journalism. Three ideas, food tape, but food tape's
Gary.
Pretty good too.
Well, this is a little bit related to homelessness, but I think it's even bigger, it's longer, and it's more of a crisis. I think we need a Marshall Plan for our inner cities, for African-American underprivileged people in this country. This is a crisis of absolute despair. It's disgraceful. That we've squandered our national treasury on idiotic Middle East wars, and we need to be looking at the greatest problem in our country, which is the deplorable state of our inner cities and the lack of opportunity. So, Clara.
Well, since Audrey stole my support media idea, I will say that...
I thought you were going to say the food tape idea.
That's weird. I will say that I've been really struck lately, whether it's terrorism or mass shootings by single individuals who are disturbed, or by mass shootings in an urban setting. I feel we have a real crisis with men going on worldwide, and I really don't know quite what to make of it, but I think it's time for us to start linking these things. We have too many young men who are too angry and feel too disaffected. There are other complicating issues with each one of those three kind of broad terrains that I laid out, but I think it's really time that we start addressing that problem, and that, you know, as parents and as teachers and as citizens, we really start addressing it early.
Over to you, Holly.
Oh, great, Ed. Well, I'm going to plus one on all of those, and mine is very little, and it is listen more, talk less, start with empathy.
Beautiful. Well, I want to thank my panelists for an amazing and stimulating. First of all, thank you for your work, and thank you for being here this evening. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you as well for turning out.